Welcome to In the Locker Room on Voice Corps. My name is Amy, filling in this week for Bob Nash. Later on in the hour, I'll read sports articles from USA Today and the New York Times and also AP. I'll begin, as Bob always does with his show, latest articles from the Buckeye Sports Bulletin. Starting with this item, Ohio State is second highest rated team in new EA College Football 27 video game, written by Bobby Gorbett, posted on June 23rd. Despite losing a big chunk of last year's team to the NFL draft, the Buckeyes have as much talent on their roster as nearly any team in college football. That's according to EA Sports. EA Sports revealed its top 10 highest-rated teams in college football on Tuesday, and the Buckeyes were tied with Indiana as the second-highest-rated team in the country with an overall rating of 90. Only Oregon was rated higher with an overall of 91. The Buckeyes' offense was the highest-rated unit of any in the country. Ohio State's offense received a 92 overall rating, while the defense received an 88 overall rating, making it the sixth highest-rated defense in the game. After a productive regular season, Ohio State's offense struggled down the stretch last year in each of its postseason losses to Indiana and Miami, Florida. Ohio State failed to score more than 14 points. However, the Buckeyes return 8 starters from that unit, including Heisman finalist quarterback Julian Sayin and superstar receiver Jeremiah Smith. The Buckeyes have some question marks on defense after losing 6 players from that unit to the NFL draft, but still have plenty of talent on that end with key players such as defensive backs Earl Little Jr. and Trey Moore, and defensive lineman James Smith coming in from the transfer portal. And speaking of committing to Ohio State, this article, also written by Bobby Gorbett, posted on June 22nd, wide receiver Austin Miller commits to Ohio State. Ohio State has landed its first commitment of the 2029 recruiting class. Bellflower, California receiver Austin Miller committed to Ohio State over USC, Oregon, and Miami, Florida on Monday night. Miller is unranked by the 247 Sports Composite, but considering he already has 19 FBS offers, that is very likely to change. Miller had an outstanding freshman season at Bellflower High School. Miller had 35 catches for 609 yards and 8 touchdowns. He also recorded 883 rushing yards and 13 rushing touchdowns. And as a defensive back, he went for 36 tackles, including 8 for loss, 4 sacks, 4 pass breakups, and a forced fumble. Miller is the first receiver to commit since Cortez Hankton took over as the program's wide receivers coach earlier this offseason. Hankton replaces Brian Hartline, who took the head coaching position at South Florida after a lengthy and wildly successful tenure as the leader of the Buckeyes' receiving room. Next from the Buckeye Sports Bulletin, this article about former head coach Jim Tressel. Written by Sam Cipriani and posted on June 23rd, former Ohio State football head coach Jim Tressel will be enshrined in Ohio Stadium's Ring of Honor during the Buckeyes' season opener against Ball State on September 5th. Growing up in Ohio, Ohio Stadium was about as special a place as there could be for a Buckeye fan, Tressel said in a statement. Then, when you have the privilege of spending so many years on the field as a coach, you never really think about something like this. You just try to honor the tradition, respect the responsibility that comes with it, and do your very best each day. I grew up admiring Paul Brown and Woody Hayes, and they both meant so much to our family, Tressel said. To be recognized alongside these men is truly humbling. Thank you to Ellen and our entire family, our players, our coaches, and support staff, to the band and the entire Buckeye Nation for the support over the years, Tressel said in his statement. I'm grateful to have been a small part of such a special tradition, and I will be forever grateful to Andy Geiger and President Britt Kerwin for giving us this extraordinary opportunity, Tressel said. Tressel spent 10 seasons as the head coach of Ohio State from 2001 through 2010, amassing a record of 94 wins, 21 losses. In parentheses, the article notes the program's wins from the 2010 season were vacated due to ineligible players from Tattoo Gate, while guiding the Buckeyes to a perfect 14-0 record and a national championship in just his second year in the year 2002. Tressel also reached the title game two other times in the years 2006 and 2007. Tressel posted a record of 56 wins, 14 losses in Big Ten play, a 9-win, 1-loss record against Michigan, including that vacated win in the year 2010, while clinching a bowl game in all of his 10 seasons with the Buckeyes. Tressel was also quite successful in getting players to the next level, with 67 Buckeyes selected in the NFL draft, including 14 in the first round. After stepping away from coaching, Tressel served as the president of Youngstown State University from 2014 through 2023, before he was appointed by Ohio Governor Mike DeWine to serve as lieutenant governor in the year 2025. Ohio State head coach Ryan Day emphasized that while Tressel's accomplishments on the field were extraordinary, his lasting impact came through the relationships he built and the lives he influenced throughout his coaching career. Coach Tressel's success on the field was remarkable, but what stands out most to me is how he invested in people, Coach Day said. He understood that coaching is much more than the game, as it is about developing leaders, building character, and preparing young men for the challenges they'll face in life after football. We're building on the legacy he and all the outstanding leaders before us created for this historic program. His legacy will always be measured not just by what his teams accomplished, but by the countless lives he helped shape through his leadership and mentorship, Coach Day said. With the honors, Tressel is the third Buckeye coach to be honored at the SHU, joining all-time greats Paul Brown, who coached from 1941 through 1943, and Woody Hayes, who coached from 1951 to 1978. Tressel is also the first addition to the Ring of Honor since 2014, when his 2006 Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, Troy Smith, was added to the C deck of Ohio Stadium. This next article from the Buckeye Sports Bulletin, posted on June 19, written by Sam Cipriani. 1973 NBA champion and former Buckeye Jerry Lucas reflects on the Knicks ending 53-year championship drought. For more than 50 years, the 1972-73 New York Knicks stood as the franchise's last championship team, their place in history untouched through decades of near misses and heartbreak. Ohio State basketball legend Jerry Lucas was on that championship-winning team and had been waiting, as many Knicks fans were, to see another title in New York. That finally changed on June 13th of this year, when head coach Mike Brown led the Knicks to their first NBA title since Lucas and his teammates brought the Larry O'Brien Trophy home to New York more than a half century earlier. As the Knicks celebrated their first NBA title since defeating the Los Angeles Lakers 4-1 in the 1973 NBA Finals, Jerry Lucas watched with nothing but happiness for the organization he helped bring a championship to more than 50 years ago. For Lucas, he could never have imagined the wait for another New York Knicks championship taking so long. "I never thought how long it might be until they win again," Lucas told Buckeye Sports Bulletin. "But as years went on, I thought, wow, hopefully they're going to be able to win it again," he said. While Lucas said he has had limited contact with members of the 2026 championship team and the current organization outside of gatherings honoring the 1972-73 title team, he has remained in touch with several of his former Knicks teammates over the years. "I've reached out to them," Lucas said. "I've talked with Earl Monroe and Bill Bradley a few times. Walt Frazier doesn't text, so it's almost impossible to reach him, and Phil Jackson doesn't communicate well. I text him once in a while, and he answers something brief," Lucas said. The 1972-73 Knicks championship team featured a whopping 9 Hall of Famers, including 8 players: Dick Barnett, Bradley, Dave DeBusschere, Walt Frazier, Jerry Lucas, Monroe, Willis, Reed, and Jackson, inducted as a coach, as well as head coach Red Holtzman. Lucas said that in his conversations with Monroe, known by many as Earl the Pearl, the two often reminisce about the Knicks' back-to-back NBA Finals matchups against the Lakers in 1972 and 73. A traditional power forward, Lucas said they frequently discuss his battles with Hall of Fame center Wilt Chamberlain, the NBA's all-time rebounding leader. With Willis Reed limited by injuries, Lucas stepped into a larger role during the 1972 Finals when the Knicks fell to the Lakers in 5 games. A year later, New York returned the favor, defeating Los Angeles to capture the 1973 NBA championship, where Reed returned to win Finals MVP. "We're a little older now, so it starts with, how are you doing? How's your family? That kind of thing," Lucas said. "Then we start talking about the Knicks, and Earl always brings up," he said, "Lucas, you started the big man going away from the basket. You shot it farther than anybody in the NBA when you played. Of course, I did that because I was playing against Wilt Chamberlain and guys who had never been away from the basket in their lives. There was no reason for a big man to go out there. Then there was no three-point line. We talked about those kinds of things and how much fun we had playing together, what a joy it was, and what a great group of people they were," Lucas said. Lucas said, stating that, though the championships came over 50 years apart, he sees many similarities between the 1972-73 Knicks and the team that ended the franchise's title drought in 2026. He highlighted both the 2026 Knicks' front court and back court, with Finals MVP Jalen Brunson running the offense and All-NBA power forward center Karl Anthony Towns anchoring the post, with a talented and supporting cast around them. "We talk about this year's team, which is kind of similar, somewhat to ours in ways. I don't think the two teams are exactly the same over time, but they were close. They had a good center and guard control. Of course, we had two of the best guards who ever played, Walt Frazier and Earl Monroe, and then we had good backup players like they had this year," Lucas said. Following the 1973 championship, Frazier has remained an integral part of the Knicks organization, Lucas said, serving as a broadcaster since he joined MSG Networks in 1987. He began on the radio before eventually teaming with play-by-play announcer Mike Breen on television. "If there is a Mr. Nick, Frazier is the one," Lucas said. "He's been with the organization for such a long time, since his playing career ended, almost to the present. He was at all the games. He traveled with the team when they went up to get their awards and stood on the stage. He was there on the stage in the background with them," Lucas said. Lucas also said the chemistry of the 2026 Knicks reminded him of his championship team, adding that the players' offensive intelligence was a major factor in their success. It was perfect. I'm telling you, it was good. We had everything. We had comics. We had stoic guys. We had everything, Lucas said. Everybody had their part and did their part. Practices were fun. Not always, but most of the time they were fun. The players basically ran the offense. Our coach, Holtzman, was a defensive coach. That was his forte. He would come in at halftime. "Okay, guys, you're not doing this," he said. "I know what's going well on offense. You guys decide what you need to do." That was basically how he coached because he knew our team knew the game, and we knew how to take advantage of certain things. So it was fun. What I really appreciated was the knowledge of the game that players had. Not just that we had some intelligent people, scholars, Phi Beta Kappas, etc., but the knowledge of the game was extraordinary, which made it a lot of fun, Lucas said. When discussing the greatest teams of all time, Lucas certainly believes the 1972-73 Knicks belong in that conversation. "We're up there," Lucas said. "I don't know where. It's hard to rate players and rate teams from different eras. I think players can be successful in any area as long as they are trained and did, you know, like whatever the players do in a certain era," Lucas said. More than five decades after helping deliver a championship to New York, Lucas no longer carries the distinction of being part of the Knicks' last title team. Instead, he gladly passes that honor to a new generation. "I'm very happy for them. I wish they had won before," Lucas said. "There is no bittersweetness. I'm not resentful in any way. I would love for the Buckeyes to win the national championship. I'd love for my high school, Middletown High School, to win the state championship again. I root for them and wish them the best," Lucas said. You're listening to In the Locker Room on Voice Corps. My name is Amy, filling in this week for Bob Nash. I'm reading articles from the Buckeye Sports Bulletin. Ohio State names Caleb Downs and Joy Dunn Athletes of the Year. Written by Sam Cipriani, posted on June 22nd. Football safety Caleb Downs and women's hockey forward Joy Dunn have been named Ohio State's Athletes of the Year, the university announced on June 22nd. The junior safety, Caleb Downs, turned in yet another dominant season in 2025. Downs recorded 68 tackles, 5 tackles for loss, 2 interceptions, 2 pass breakups, and 2 forced fumbles. His standout campaign earned him unanimous All-America honors for the second straight season while claiming the Jim Thorpe Award and Lott Impact Trophy. Downs was also named the Big Ten Nagurski Woodson Defensive Player of the Year and Tatum Woodson Defensive Back of the Year, becoming just the second safety in conference history to earn Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year honors, joining former Buckeye Mike Doss from 2002. The 6-foot, 205-pound safety finished his collegiate career with 257 tackles, 16 tackles for loss, 6 interceptions, and 11 pass breakups across 44 starts. Following the season, Downs was selected number 11 overall by the Dallas Cowboys in the 2026 NFL Draft. Joy Dunn, meanwhile, completed her junior campaign for Ohio State on the ice while also helping the United States capture Olympic gold at the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milan and Cortina in Italy. A Patty Kazmaier Award top 10 finalist for the second consecutive season, the junior forward led Ohio State with 27 goals and 51 points during the 2025-26 season, becoming just the second player in program history to lead the team in scoring for 3 consecutive years. She also tied for the team with a plus 50 plus minus rating in 31 games. Her efforts earned her second-team All-America honors and helped lead Ohio State to its 5th straight national championship game appearance. The O'Fallon, Missouri native also helped the Buckeyes take home their first WCHA final faceoff championship since the year 2022. During the Olympic break, Dunn made an immediate impact for Team USA. As the youngest player on the American roster, Dunn worked her way onto the first line for the gold medal game and finished the tournament with 3 goals and 2 assists in 7 games as the United States captured its first Olympic gold medal in women's hockey since 2018. The honor places both Buckeyes on the ballot for the Big Ten Athlete of the Year Awards, which the conference will announce in July. 2029 quarterback prospect Ty Snell intrigued by Ohio State early in his recruiting process. This article, written by Sam Cipriani and posted on June 21st. One of the nation's emerging prospects in the 2029 recruiting class, Allen, Texas quarterback Ty Snell, made another trip to Ohio State for a one-day summer camp as he continues to evaluate the Buckeyes as one of the top schools on his radar. At Ohio State's camp last Thursday, June 18, Snell spent time working with quarterbacks coach Billy Fessler and program assistant Colin Keno, coming away impressed by what he experienced in Columbus. "It was great," Snell said. "I got to learn a lot from Coach C.K. and Coach Fessler. It was amazing," he said. Ohio State's interest in Snell dates back more than a year, with the Buckeyes offering the Allen signal caller on June 12, 2025, following his performance at one of the program's summer camps. Since then, Snell's recruitment has kicked into another gear. He currently holds 35 Division I offers, with a handful coming from national powers, including Oregon, Georgia, Alabama, LSU, and Indiana. Despite the growing list of suitors, Ohio State remains firmly in the mix for Snell's pledge. "Ohio State is one of the schools on my board that I'm thinking of choosing," Snell said. "I'm just learning how they teach, how they process, and how they practice this morning." Snell has been busy on the camp circuit this off-season, making visits to Alabama, Texas, USC, and UCLA over the summer before arriving in Columbus. He said Ohio State's reputation and winning culture are among the factors drawing him to the program. "Just the fight, the drive, and the recognition that the Ohio State program receives," Snell said. While he is still early in his recruitment, Snell already has a clear understanding of his strengths as a quarterback. "I'm a pro-style quarterback who can throw the ball wherever," Snell said. "I'm able to get out of the pocket and get some yards if I need to." Snell said versatility as a quarterback, as well as his hardworking and competitive nature, are traits that have stood out to Fessler and the Ohio State coaching staff. Coming off a freshman season at Allen High School, one of the nation's premier high school football programs, Snell said competing in Texas's Class 6A Division I has helped prepare him for the next level. "Just the level that I'm at, 6A Division I at Allen, you play the best kids, Duncanville, DeSoto, South Lake Carroll," Snell said. Snell also pointed to former South Lake Carroll wide receiver Brock Boyd, a 3-star recruit for Ohio State in the class of 2026, as an example of the elite talent regularly found across Texas high school football. As a freshman in 2025, Snell completed 67 of 98 passes for 1,030 yards and 10 touchdowns against just 3 interceptions. He also added 161 rushing yards and 2 scores on the ground. Although he has already begun attracting attention from some of college football's biggest programs, Snell believes his best football is still ahead of him and is looking to prove his doubters wrong in his sophomore campaign at Allen. "This will be my first full season of starting," Snell said, "so I definitely want to actually show what I can do and what I've made of to everybody who has been hating on me," Snell said. And one more from the Buckeye Sports Bulletin. NCAA approves new 5-year eligibility model. Written by Bobby Gorbett and posted on June 23rd, late in the afternoon. More change is on the way to collegiate athletics. The NCAA's Division I cabinet approved a new eligibility model on Tuesday that will give student athletes 5 years to complete 5 years of eligibility. The 5 years of eligibility must be completed within 5 years of high school graduation or an athlete's 19th birthday, whichever comes first. As part of the change, red shirts and eligibility waivers will be eliminated. Only certain circumstances, such as religious missions, maternity leave, or active duty military service, could result in eligibility extensions. The rule change will go into effect this fall and is expected to apply to student athletes who still have eligibility following the 2025-26 academic year. Athletes who had their eligibility expire in spring of 2026 will not be eligible. The NCAA had previously allowed athletes to complete 4 years of eligibility in 5 years, with some student athletes still competing in their mid-20s after receiving additional injury waivers. The cabinet's decision will not be finalized until the conclusion of its meeting later on Wednesday. But it appears the new eligibility model will give athletes a definite timeline to complete their eligibility. You're listening to In the Locker Room on Voice Corps. My name is Amy, filling in this week for Bob Nash. I'll turn now to the Associated Press, their sports section, and begin with this article about the NBA draft. The Tuesday night results. This article was posted on Tuesday evening, written by Brian Mahoney, Dateline New York. AJ DeBanza is on his way to Washington and ready to start working as soon as he gets there. That's not until Wednesday. Tuesday was a night for the NBA's number one draft pick to party. Obviously, this night is just a celebration of all the hard work I've done in the past, and so now I'm going to celebrate, DeBanza said. So were a record number of one-and-done college stars who followed him, a trio of national champions from Michigan, and fans of both New York teams on what sounded like an even more festive NBA draft than usual. The Wizards started it by selecting DeBanza, a forward who led the nation in scoring in his one season at BYU. He averaged 25.5 points, highlighted by a 43-point effort that broke BYU's freshman scoring record and was the first of a record-tying 8 straight college freshmen taken to begin the draft. That matched the record set last year. Morez Johnson Jr. at number 9 was the first non-freshman. At 6'9", 217 pounds, DeBanza has drawn comparisons to Kevin Durant, who happens to be his favorite player. Durant grew up in the Washington area, and Wizards fans can only hope DeBanza can live up to the comparisons. Freshman Darren Peterson of Kansas was taken as the number 2 pick by Utah. Cameron Boozer, the College Player of the Year in his one season at Duke, was taken at number 3 in the draft by Memphis. Caleb Wilson, another freshman forward from North Carolina, went to Chicago with the next pick. At number 5, the Los Angeles Clippers acquired Illinois guard Keaton Wagler. Then the Brooklyn Nets went with Louisville guard Mikael Brown Jr. Michigan's men make their mark. Darius Acuff Jr. went to Sacramento at number 7 and Kingston Fleming's to Atlanta at number 8. That continued the run of scoring guards before Dallas went back to the bigs and created a reunion in the process by taking Morez Johnson Jr. from Michigan. Johnson was congratulated by national champion Michigan teammates Yaxel Lendenborg and Ade Mara, who were also in the green room, and then hugged his old and new coach, Dusty May, who left the Michigan Wolverines to coach the Dallas Mavericks on the eve of the draft. And Lindenborg and Mara did not have to wait long for their turn to be picked. The Golden State Warriors took Lindenberg with the number 11 pick, and the Oklahoma City Thunder followed by going for Mara. This next article from USA Today, and it's about the World Cup FIFA soccer tournament. And the U.S. team is number one in its group and is scheduled to play Thursday, 10 p.m. It'll be on Fox Television. They play against Turkey Thursday night at 10. The U.S. team in World Cup FIFA soccer. This article, though, it's an opinion piece by the USA Today columnist Ingrid Jacques. World Cup fans love the USA. I'll be perfectly honest, my interest in soccer extends about as far as Ted Lasso and the rather nice physiques of the players. Yet, as World Cup fans from around the globe have descended on America, I have found myself extremely interested in their perceptions of the country. Europeans especially seem bewitched by the sheer bigness of it all, from the spacious Western grandeur to supersized gas stations like Buc-ee's. It's adorable. What's not so cute is the shock some of my fellow Americans seem to be feeling at these expressions of true awe and joy from our visitors. The pushback, largely from coastal liberal elites, revolves around this theme. Since Donald Trump is president, the rest of the world must feel the same shame and horror that we do. They don't, though. America is so much bigger than one man, and it's refreshing to see these candid takes at a time when so many U.S. citizens, well, the Democrats anyway, are down on their country. To give you a taste of the outpouring of affection for American traditions, I'll share a few of the social media posts that have gone viral. This is so surreal. Just had the best food ever. That came from Elsa, who is Swedish. Why did no one tell me ranch sauce is like crack? Europe, we need ranch sauce. And then there is Freddy the German, who has amassed a huge following as he traverses around to World Cup games. Just had our first Waffle House experience at 1 a.m. Great food, great prices, and friendly staff. We will be coming back. Freddie also was in awe of the Buc-ee's gas stations. Dude, this is a gas station, he exclaimed, with three crying face emojis. That post alone has attracted nearly 26 million views. A fan from England had this to say about her fast food experience. This is the best food I've ever had in my life. America, you keep on delivering. This enthusiasm is being met with pure suspicion and surprise by U.S. journalists. Will Oremus of The Atlantic, for instance, doubts that these posts by international tourists are anything more than bids for internet fame, while condescendingly allowing that no doubt at least some of the mutual enthusiasm between Americans and visiting soccer fans is sincere. And although Constance Grady of Vox says she's a fan of all the tourist love for America, she's surprised nonetheless that it's arriving at this, quote, moment. The 2026 World Cup has become a global love fest for the U.S. at a time when the rest of the world has plenty of reasons to dislike us, Grady says. A World Cup hosted by the United States under the xenophobic Trump administration had all the makings of a disaster, Grady said. Again, these soccer fanatics don't care about Trump. They care about the abundant American way of life that too many of us simply take for granted. The Economist recently observed the American wealth enticing holidaymakers troubles European elites. America, once a peer, seems to be racing ahead. The American economy is far from perfect, and Americans are feeling the continued pain of inflation and high grocery bills, but we rarely measure it against what our fellow humans across the globe face. We are a remarkably wealthy country and the envy of much of the world, even though progressives and Trump haters will try to claim otherwise. The tourist all for Walmart and Buc-ee's, that should serve as a reminder of how lucky we are. And that is Ingrid Jacques. She is an opinion columnist at USA Today, posting that piece on USA Today on June 24th. This next article, also from USA Today, the sports columnist Nancy Armour, writing about the coach of the U.S. men's soccer team. Mauricio Pochettino is leaving his mark on the team. This article posted on June 24th, Dateline Laguna Niguel, California. The wall behind Mauricio Pochettino's desk in his office at the U.S. Men's National Team Hotel is covered in motivational phrases. If I dream of touching the moon, maybe I can get close to it. If I only dream of getting close, I'll stay on Earth. The talent has brought us here, but it is the heart, effort, and unity that will make us unforgettable. Believe, work, compete. Everything represents our journey from day one until today, Pochettino said during a roundtable with a small group of reporters on Tuesday, June 23rd, 2 days before the U.S. men's national team wraps up the World Cup group stage against Turkey. And what a journey it's been. If you are new to all this or have paid only fleeting attention since the last World Cup held in the country of Qatar, what the Americans have done in the first 2 weeks of the tournament is probably about what you expected with a high-profile coach like Pochettino. They won their group for the first time since the year 2010, and their two wins are their most in the group stage since 1930. They've already scored 6 goals, one shy of their record for the entire World Cup. They've got fans singing John Denver. Easy as Pochettino and his staff, and with Pochettino it is always a collective effort, are making it seem it's been anything but. Maybe we didn't feel or saw how difficult was going to be the process. We were so naive when we signed the contract, he said. We misjudged the situation. It was worse than we really believed, he said. No country or club switches coaches because things are going well, especially not when the World Cup is less than 2 years away, a World Cup you are hosting for only the second time. Pochettino will not speak ill of his predecessor, Greg Berhalter, but one look at the results tells the story. This is the golden generation of the U.S. men's national team with an abundance of world-class talent. But the Americans were stagnating, showing no sign they were going to close the gap on the rest of the world anytime soon. When Pochettino and his staff arrived, they expected players would feel the same sense of urgency as they did. The World Cup, their World Cup, was right around the corner. The reality was different. We don't say that we have better standard, better culture, better habit. We come with different things, and we wanted to make the things how we really feel. And that is always a process to change, Pochettino said. If you have the habit to every morning to go somewhere and someone says, no, you cannot go there, you are going to fight because it was your comfort zone and you say, no, I want my comfort zone. Pochettino was a longtime club manager before he came to the U.S. men's national team. Making cultural changes with a club team is different because you're with the players for 9 months out of the year. The U.S. men's national team gathers every 6 to 8 weeks, and the longest stretch they're together is at a World Cup. On top of that, Pochettino was trying to figure out who his players were, what strengths they had, where they needed to add depth. Pettuccino's resume speaks for itself. He won roughly 50% of the games he's managed, and he's made every team he's gone to better. Most of his staff has been with him for years, if not decades, and they have found a system that works. Training sessions are intense, and talent will only get you so far. Soccer rewards work, Pettuccino said. That the U.S. men's national team would get punched in the nose, as Pettuccino puts it, at some point during the transition process was inevitable. It happened in March 2025 when the U.S. men's national team lost to Panama in the Nations League semifinals. It was the first of four consecutive losses. That was good crash, Pettuccino said. When we detect all the problems, we go for the solution, and we knew that the solution will arrive. The object is to challenge people. We challenge the organization. We challenge players. We challenge everyone. Pettuccino has won league titles and taken a team to the Champions League final. He had options when U.S. soccer came calling, but part of the appeal of this job was the cultural shift, not only for a team, but an entire country. About a year after he was hired, Pettuccino went to the Texas-Ohio State football game. Looking around the stadium filled with more than 100,000 rabid fans, he imagined the U.S. men drawing a crowd like that, of soccer being center stage, like it is in Europe and South America. My question was, why not? If fans are very passionate, why not with us? Why not with soccer? Pettuccino said. To help, to evolve in a very good direction, the sport that we really love. Why not be here, be part of something that can create a legacy, he said. That idea of why not eventually evolved into why not us. It was something Pettuccino said at a meeting in November 2025, and it's become something of a mantra for the U.S. men's national team. If we believe we can do it. If we work hard, we can do. If we change our mindset, we can do, Pettuccino said. And that is, why not us? Even in the weeks leading up to the World Cup, no one knew quite what to expect from this team. It had talent, of course, but it had been soundly beaten by Belgium and Portugal to start the year. It barely got by Senegal and then lost to Germany in the send-off games. When the U.S. men's national team got to the World Cup, however, it hit the gas. Paraguay and Australia might not be the caliber of France or Argentina, but they are solid teams, and the U.S. team dominated both. Pettuccino likened this sudden turnaround, he said, to gardening. You plant a seed, and for a time nothing happens. Then one day there is a tree. It's difficult to analyze the process, Pettuccino said. The process was a process that was necessary to change, to really change things and to go in the good direction, no? Always the orientation was to make them better and to give the possibility, the platform, for them to perform. That is Maurizio Pettuccino, the coach of the U.S. men's national team in the World Soccer Cup. Again, the men play Thursday night at 10 against Turkey, and you'll be able to find that game on Fox. And that was a piece written by the USA Today sports columnist Nancy Armour and posted on Wednesday, June 24th. You're listening to In the Locker Room on Voice Corps. My name is Amy, filling in this week for Bob Nash. This next article is from the AP Sports website about the Olympics. 2029, to be exact. The host is set to be announced. This article by Graham Dunbar and posted on June 24th, Dateline Lausanne, Switzerland. The International Olympic Committee set a target of 2029 on Wednesday, June 24th, to pick a host for the 2036 Olympics in a currently stalled contest that has long been targeted by India and Qatar. The timetable agreed at a meeting of the full International Olympic Committee membership is a reset under the president, Kirsty Coventry, after a 2028 Summer Games host Los Angeles and the 2032 host Brisbane were chosen 11 years in advance. It brings back a competitive vote wanted by members after LA and Brisbane were effectively chosen without facing a rival candidate. The 2024 Olympics host Paris was picked with the traditional 7 years to prepare in 2017 when LA stood aside as a rival to be given the 2028 edition uncontested. The strategic shift has been a defining move in Coventry's presidency that formally started exactly 1 year ago when she succeeded Thomas Bach. At least 10 potential Summer Games bids for 2036 and beyond had been in ongoing talks with the International Olympic Committee when President Coventry pressed pause on the process in the first big decision of her presidency, detailing the new timetable. The International Olympic Committee member, Kolinda Grabar-Kitrovich, said the contest should take shape in March of next year. The International Olympic Committee's executive board will pick an official shortlist for deeper evaluation of a number of interested parties with developed projects, according to the committee. A target of late 2028 was set to begin a targeted dialogue phase with bidders when their governments will be required to give legal and financial guarantees. The host of the 2036 Olympics, the election of that host is set to be at the committee's session beginning in mid-2029 at a venue yet to be decided. I'll turn now to the Columbus Dispatch sports section for this article about the U.S. Senior Open coming to the area. U.S. Senior Open fan guide and tickets and player field. This is written by Dan Allback of the Dispatch, posted on June 24th. Central Ohio golf fans, so recently treated to June's Memorial Tournament in Dublin, are getting another chance to watch some of the best in the sport. The U.S. Senior Open is headed to the Scioto Country Club in Upper Arlington for the first time since the year 2016. The tournament will be held July 2nd through the 5th and will feature many former major champion golfers and prominent names from the PGA Tour champions. Gene Sowers, who is in the field for the 2026 tournament, won the last Senior Open at Scioto. Here's what fans need to know. The Senior Open is July 2nd through the 5th at the Scioto Country Club in Upper Arlington. Is the Senior Open part of the PGA Tour? No. The Senior Open is administered by the United States Golf Association, not the PGA Tour. It is also a senior event with a minimum age of 50 required to qualify for the tournament. And here is what's known about the schedule. Starting Wednesday, July 1st, it's a practice round. The gates open at 7 a.m. Players will have the option of starting practice rounds. And it is typical for players to be on the golf course or the practice areas until at least 7 p.m. On Thursday, July 2nd, it's the first tournament round. The gates open at 6:30 a.m. Tee times begin at 7. The last groups play at 2:30. On Friday, July 3rd, it's the second tournament round. Saturday, July 4th, the third tournament round. Again, the gates open at 6:30 a.m. The first tee pairing starts around 8 a.m., the last tee pairing around 12:45 p.m., and on Sunday, July 5th, it's the final tournament round. The first tee pairing starts at 8 a.m., the last tee pairing around 1 p.m. Daily gallery tickets are available for purchase. Those who buy these tickets will have general admission to the grounds and access to walk the course and the various public grandstands. Concessions will be available for purchase, and there are also daily trophy club tickets available, which have the same perks as a daily gallery ticket with additional access to the trophy club. between holes 14 and 15. The club is a climate-controlled facility with upgraded food and beverage options for purchase, live television coverage, and executive restrooms. Weekly tickets, which provide one ticket entry for all 5 days of the tournament, are $220 for the standard version and $358 for the Trophy Club edition. The current field for the U.S. Senior Open features 156 players. Some of the notable golfers: Ernie Els, Vijay Singh, Michael Block, Angel Cabrera, Padraig Harrington, Tom Lehman, Ian Poulter, Gene Sowers, Henrik Stenson. Will Tiger Woods play? Tiger Woods is not in the field for the Senior Open. Tiger Woods registered for the 2026 U.S. Senior Open, according to a spokesperson for the Golf Association, but Tiger Woods was deciding whether to play at a later date. Woods was involved in a car crash in Jupiter Island, Florida on March 27 and was arrested then on suspicion of DUI. How much is the tournament purse? Golfers will be vying for a share of a $4 million purse when the 2026 U.S. Senior begins tournament play on July 2nd. Last year's winner, Padraig Harrington, took home $800,000 of that $4 million total purse. Who has the most wins? Miller Barber is the only golfer to win the U.S. Senior Open 3 times. That was in the years 1982, 84, and 85. And golfers who have won twice: Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, Hale Irwin, Alan Doyle, Kenny Perry, Bernard Langer, and Padraig Harrington. The cell phone policy. Fans are encouraged to capture their favorite moments and stay connected to family and friends while at the U.S. Senior Open. You may carry your mobile device that is smaller than 7 inches in length, and device volume controls must be set to silent or vibrate. Flash photography must be disabled. Phone calls should be limited to areas away from play, and not in any area that may disrupt play, including the grandstands. Photography, video, and audio recording are permitted throughout the course, but content must not be used for commercial purposes. Live streaming or shot-by-shot coverage of any player, with or without video, is not permitted at any time throughout championship week. All posted signage and instructions from championship staff and volunteers must be observed. And the bag policy is no bags larger than 6 by 6 by 6 inches. Transparent and clear plastic handbags and shoulder bags are permitted, 12 inches high, 6 inches deep for those bags. The camera policy: cameras are permitted only Monday through Wednesday during practice rounds. Phone cameras are permitted. Golf etiquette: stay behind the gallery ropes and follow championship marshals. Be considerate and kneel or sit if you are in the front row of a gallery. Stay quiet when players are about to hit. Keep cell phones on silent or vibrate at all times. Walk carefully and never run. What to wear for this U.S. Senior Open? The U.S. Golf Association recommends wearing appropriate footwear such as sneakers or golf shoes to walk on the grassy hills and dirt paths on the course, as well as sunscreen, a hat, and sunglasses for protection against the sun. The Scioto Country Club. There have been 5 previous U.S. Golf Association events at Scioto, including the 1926 U.S. Open. In 2016, it hosted the U.S. Senior Open, won by Gene Sowers. 1986 hosted the U.S. Senior Open, won by Dale Douglas. 1968, the U.S. Amateur, won by Bruce Fleischer. And in 1926, the U.S. Open, won by Bobby Jones. The broadcast schedule on the Golf Channel, of course. Everything starting on Thursday, July 2nd, will be on the Golf Channel. Also carrying coverage this year is the streamer Peacock. In the late afternoon, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., that is Thursday, July 2nd, Friday, July 3rd, Saturday, July 4th. On Saturday, July 4th, the third round coverage begins at noon on Peacock. NBC will carry it on Saturday afternoon, 2 to 5 p.m. on NBC. Then on Sunday, July 5th, the final round on the streamer Peacock from 1 to 3 p.m., then on NBC from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. And that is what you need to know about the U.S. Senior Open Golf Tournament coming to the Scioto Country Club in Upper Arlington, July 2nd through the 5th. And I'll finish with an AP sports item. Couple of notes about hockey. The NHL is exploring potential expansion in Texas in either Houston or Austin under an agreement with billionaire Dan Friedkin and his family, the hockey commissioner Gary Bettman said on Tuesday. Bettman said the Board of Governors endorsed a term sheet agreed to with the Friedkins over the next 6 months. Discussions over the past 2 years largely revolved around Houston, before Austin joined the conversation. Friedkin is chairman and CEO of the Friedkin Group with a net worth of $6.4 billion. That's according to Forbes. The Houston-based consortium has investments in the automotive industry, entertainment, hospitality, and sports. No board vote was taken yet. That will come if the sides involved move forward with an agreement. While there is no guarantee the NHL adds a 33rd team, the move is a first step toward becoming the largest professional sports league in North America, surpassing the NFL. Commissioner Bettman has said officials were listening to expressions of interest from prospective owners in places like Houston and Atlanta. And one more item about hockey. This article notes that Commissioner Bettman said the board has approved the sale of the Pittsburgh Penguins from the Fenway Sports Group to the Hoffman family. The deal, reached a year ago, is worth $1.7 billion. It's nice that the Hoffmans got a good deal, Bettman said. In a statement released by the team, the incoming NHL Governor Jeff Hoffman called it a defining moment for his family. And that is all for In the Locker Room. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCorps, your audio access to the world.